Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey Blenders, it's Sean, and I'm here to introduce a bonus episode with a really special director. Oliver Stone is joining the show this week to talk about JFK. This is one of those rare opportunities that we get because of a home video opportunity, and this is the 30th anniversary of JFK, the movie that Oliver Stone made that starred Kevin Costner and explored the controversies behind the JFK assassination and the case that Jim Garrison brought up to get into some more information about the Warren Commission and the Zapruder film and all the things that made him pretty interested in the fact that a lot of the facts he thought were being overlooked in the investigation. But it's a film that Oliver Stone, you can tell throughout the course of this interview, is still really, really passionate about, and specifically about how it was received. This was a Best Picture nominee, and he earned a Best Director nomination for it as well, too, and it contended against some really heavy hitters, losing to Silence of the Lambs, obviously, at the Oscars. So a well-received film, in our opinion, and one that that I personally go back to and check often, as I mentioned in the interview, as you're going to hear. This is a 7-course meal of a movie. There's so much information. I feel like every time I go back to it, I pick up more about not just the investigation, but really a respect of Oliver Stone as a filmmaker and the way that he's able to put the sheer amount of information that's in a movie like JFK into the edit, which is something that he discusses in the interview that you're about to hear. We talk a lot about how much fun it is to get a director for a very specific project that we admire, and we don't have to really sneak in questions about something like JFK, where at the end of an interview we might be like, hey, it's 30 years of JFK, what do you remember about working on this? We were able to really take a deep dive into his filmmaking process, being on the ground in Dallas to shoot at very specific locations, this incredible cast that he put together for the benefit of the movie. I love the way that he talks about working with a lot of these character actors that he admired. And of course, just everything that he got out of Kevin Costner for this outstanding, outstanding performance. So it's a great opportunity for you guys to maybe revisit JFK, catch up with it in this director's cut version, and maybe get ready for a longer cut, as he'll talk about. But without further ado, it's the Real Blend interview with Oliver Stone on behalf of JFK. Mr. Stone, we are a filmmaker-driven podcast. We'd love to get into the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts, so please feel free to get as geeky and technical as you can. But I want to start with a bigger picture type question and just sort of ask, having revisited this director's cut, it is an exquisite sort of 7-course meal of information. And every time I go back to it, I feel like I learn even more than I knew going into it. But I wanted to know 30 years later if the movie triggered the amount of conversation and even the types of conversations that you were hoping that it would when you went into the production on it.
Beyond what I was hoping. I didn't realize there was such interest in the case. It was really buried in the memory. It was sort of a thing that was, it just broke. I mean, as you know, the film, I thought it would be my last film. You know, it was 3 hours and 15 minutes. It was very risky, and maybe, you know, too much talk and too much Sherlock Holmes stuff. I figured, you know, this is maybe the film, but at least I was happy with the film, and that was what mattered. So I really bulldozed it through. I had some influence with Warner Brothers, and I know that they wanted to get it out for Christmas, so. That was a very good position. When time is running out, you can always say, well, if you want me to go back and make changes, we're not going to make Christmas. So I kind of used that strategy.
You know, Mr. Stone, I've always been interested in asking this because I'm a big Robert Richardson fan. I think he's one of the greatest DPs in the history of cinema. And the way you go back and forth between different film stocks and different, like 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter, 8 millimeter, there's so many different film stocks and like archival footage you're using throughout the film. What were the conversations like with Robert Richardson about what film stock to use when? Like, how did you figure that out? How did you guys have the discussion?
Listen, it was very natural. It was instinctive. Bob and I had by this time made 4 or 5 films together. So we had reached a level of intuition. And it's not like on the page we said this is going to be, yeah, we sometimes we decided that it was clearly newsreel type footage, or we wanted to go to eight millimeter. But you know, I would just walk over to Bob and say, let's do this in 16, or let's do this in Super 35. And he was, you know, he'd come back, he said, let's try this. It was just that kind of we were on a roll. You know, we'd done The Doors and we had done Born on the 4th of July, which is a very big, complicated film. So we had confidence. And we also done, I have to say, Salvador and Platoon. Salvador was a nightmare to make. We had no money. So during that film, we bonded in a sense that very deeply. So we'd seen everything. But after Salvador, we thought we'd seen everything. And we were ready to take on bigger responsibilities.
Wow.
Well, to that end, when you're putting together a film like this and you have to decide that you're going to break up a lengthy monologue or a large chunk of exposition, and as you mentioned, there's a lot of it in this film, with either archival footage or a recreation, when do you decide when is the right moment to put in a recreation? And could you talk a little bit about setting your recreations to match your archival footage? It's remarkable how often it does it in JFK.
We tried everything. I mean, the editing is the key. Yeah, because obviously this is after the film is shot. And I supervised the editors. There were three editors and one major assistant who really became a fourth editor. And we were fighting time. So I would go from room to room and supervise the cut. One of the most interesting things that happened is that the Donald Sutherland stuff, which is now in the middle of the film, was split in two. It's in the middle and it was at the end as a wrap up.
Oh, wow.
And, oh, wow.
It just didn't work. And that was a big adjustment. We had to go back and recut that and put it all. I wanted everything in the middle because that ups the ante completely. And what is Costner going to do? He's overwhelmed by all this information. And the truth was that Garrison was overwhelmed. He realized that he was up against a covert military. He was up against a covert operation. And that's the hardest thing to prove in court.
Right. I couldn't imagine the film not ending with the courtroom. I'm sorry. That's stunning.
You know, hey, I think it was unfair with some of the criticism because we showed it as it came down. He was found innocent by Shaw and he was released. And Costner walked out very disappointed. Of course, several of his witnesses had died. And David Ferry and Guy Bannister's, his case did fall apart. But he kept going because he felt like this was a way, and he says it in the film, this is a way to catch. If I can keep going, there are going to be shreds like the old man in the sea when the fish comes in, you know, you're going to still have some shreds. And frankly, that's the only public prosecution. As a result of Garrison's trial, we learned a lot.
Right.
About the autopsy at the beginning, he unearthed the Zapruder film and he showed it to the jury. So Jim is much maligned, and I think he's a very serious man, and I think he was, I can't tell you how he was destroyed in the press.
You know, Mr. Stone, I've always found this really interesting, because I'm in D.C., and Sean's in Charlotte, but I'm in D.C., and I wanted to ask about your memories in terms of, like, the film coming out, the Congress and that aspect of it, and kind of what it did to change aspects of people's access to certain things. Like, is it true that you showed the film to Congress in 91? Do I have that right?
No, I don't think we ever had a screening for all of the Congress. That'd be gigantic. I'm sure we showed it in Washington, its various screening rooms. I don't remember exactly, but all this came about after the film came out. So we've gone through so much abuse and also praise. I have to be honest, we had a lot of praise. So it was very controversial and people were going to the film, which surprised me. I didn't expect this. We made quite a bit of money domestically and foreign. It was all over the world.
Wow.
And people wanted to see it. So when I testified, I was my first time. Of course, it's nerve-wracking, but it was a simple request. It was thrown in at the last second by our PR people. They said, you know, let's get the files open. Let's get the files open, which is a good idea. It's a hook. It's a hook, you know. Open the files. What the hell is so secret about that you have to sit on until 2029? Which was the House Select Assassinations Committee in 77, 79 had classified much of their stuff. So it was impossible to get to unless we opened it. So we were essentially the third official investigation, although I'd say that Congress didn't put much energy into the bill. The bill allowed them to declassify what they wanted, but the CIA, Secret Service, I mean, they didn't cooperate, and they made it very hard. They stonewalled these academics who were not very vicious and tough like you have to be. But it was a third investigation. And this is interesting because the press never reported what was being discovered, right? A lot of files were, 60,000 files were uncovered. And it's a lot of detail. It's all detail. In a murder case, you have to go to detail. Mm-hmm. It's like Sherlock Holmes always says that, look at the details with a magnifying glass. And this whole community of researchers that we have in America, it's amazing what they've done. They, without making a profit to it, they just wanted to solve this case. They went into all the details of every frame. It's the guy who wrote the script, Jim DiEugenio, is one of those guys. He has an incredible memory. He doesn't forget. He reads a document, he remembers it. I can't. So they put together a very good, and they took all this material and they analyzed it, and we came up. This film is the result of that. It's taking some of that material and making it clear as a legacy piece that this is what happened. And there's also a 4-hour version too, which is coming out in February.
Oh my gosh.
Those people who want to follow up on it. We take it very seriously. It doesn't register on the national media at all. They don't have any responsibility. And in my mind, they were complicit from the beginning with this thing. Complicit. They just went along, or lazy. They didn't want to bother with it. It was too scary a story.
Mr. Stone, I've always found you to be an incredible filmmaker for two main reasons. One, you make entertaining films, but at the same time, I learned so much watching your films. And one of the beauties of you as a filmmaker is when I watch your work, I can feel the passion of what you're trying to do through the work, because it's important what you're trying to tell people. And I wanted to ask you, as a director, like, in your mind, balancing that, the idea of like, okay, we need to entertain an audience, but at the same time, I'm very passionate about the material and I want this to get across. So how do you, I'm sure it's probably a balancing act you've probably been trying to figure out for years, but how do you decide on that and balance?
I don't think there's a contradiction. I think that if you know the material and you find it exciting to you, it'll be exciting to others, because I have an ability to alkalize alchemy. You make something, it works if you're genuine and passionate. And I think that's true for every, no matter what film you do. So it's a nice conjunction when the audience and you come together. Very rarely does it happen. I mean, passion, of course, can lead you the wrong way. I don't want to be feverishly passionate about something that could be wrong. So I had a lot of people around me who were in the research community. I had good advisors. I had people come in. I talked to a lot of people as I was making the film. Didn't want to make a fool of myself. And we've learned more since 1991, but that film essentially holds.
Yeah, no, it really does. I'm also stunned going back to revisit it of the sheer amount of amazing actors that you had lined up for this one. Yeah. And I mean, like, you'll get Walter Matthau for... a scene, essentially. So can you talk about the casting process? Were people lined up at the door to contribute to this one with you? Are there certain people that you wanted to get that you maybe didn't get?
At the time, I think, first of all, Warner Brothers wanted to make the film with me. They liked me. And I sold it to them as a murder story that would put a lot of tension, an investigatory that sort of along the lines of the thriller films in the 70s. They wanted a star because the budget was bigger than, it was 40 million plus 42 million. Mm. Costner was their ace in the hole. He had just done Robin Hood for them.
Mm, yeah.
He was their ace in the hole. So Harrison Ford turned it down, and I don't know if Mel Gibson turned it down, but anyway, we ended up going to Kevin, and he was scared of it a bit. His wife played a key role here at that time. She played a key role. And Mike Ovitz, at CAA played a key role in bringing him into the film. The more he read, the more he researched, the more involved he got. Mm-hmm. The other thing that was true about this film is that I got the star, but in other words, they didn't care about who I cast in the smaller roles, but I cared, because if you think about how complicated the film is, you want to have a face like Jack Lemmon or Walter Matthau or John Candy or Kevin Bacon, somebody who can make an impact in a few moments so that you remember the link, because a lot of this evidence is tricky. So you remember, oh, that's the woman who. So I tried to make it so it would be visually memorable.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't believe that Costner didn't get an Oscar nomination. Like, I was looking back over the sheer number of nominations that the film got, I was like, well, clearly he got in there. And when he wasn't there, I was blown away.
No, there was, there's a lot of old guard in Hollywood, and there was certainly a strong negative reaction too.
Mm. Yeah, Mr. Stone, you mentioned Harrison Ford passing on the film, and like you think about like history and like movies and who would have been in what role, and it is interesting to go down that rabbit hole, but obviously whatever we end up with is what we know. But I was just curious, like, in terms of Harrison Ford, when he passes on a movie, like, do you meet with him first? Are you guys working together for a bit of time? Like, what was that process with Harrison like?
No, I met with him. We talked about the film. He read the script and he passed. I don't think it was like the script. It was like he didn't want to get involved in the sense of, I think he sensed that it was a hot potato. But you never know.
Yeah, that's interesting.
This film is, I believe, the second of three collaborations that you've done with John Williams. And I was curious because he's, largely considered Spielberg's guy, and Spielberg approaches history in a different way. When do you realize that the project you have is what John, it requires what John Williams can bring?
John Williams is John Williams. Beyond Spielberg, he is a modern maestro, and he's done so much. I mean, he's an institution. And he loved Kennedy. I sensed that right away. In fact, it's interesting to note that he wrote the score, the first draft of the score, off the script. In fact, he may have started it before he even saw the script, because when we went to him, JFK meant something to him, and I think he was paying respect to him by writing the score with a profound score.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's incredible. I was reading somewhere, and I you never know what you're reading on the internet, if it's real or not, but I believe you shot some of these scenes in the real locations that the events occurred. And I wanted to ask you about some of those specific locations that you sought out and how you were able to kind of pull that off. And like, was there a particular location that was more tricky for you to be able to like execute?
Oh yeah, it was Dealey Plaza was our opening. We went right to the horse's mouth. I mean, that's very complicated technical stuff. And we shot the president, the actor who played him, we shot him at least 10, 20 times, in various positions for the angles. We had a lot of camera. And
wow,
in the middle of Dallas, which is not that big a city, I mean, you can hear the shots and it reverberates through the canyons, and it was quite something to see a motorcade like break into chaos, and people got into it, man. It was, I believe, 2 to 3 weeks there. I was exhausted because I was running from one end of Dealey Plaza to the other. It was, we had so much to think about. It was really one of the most complicated layouts, but we got everything, and we never went back. I don't think we could have gone back. We got permission barely from the Denver City Council, I think by one vote. And our location manager was on top of the board, taking them out to dinner, trying to charm them. But I think the vote was 3-2, something like that, to permit us to shoot there, because they thought, I'd made Born on the 4th of July. That was okay. But I was controversial too, I'd also made the Sixth Floor Museum, which is up there, is a bit of a fraud, it really is, in the sense that they sell you the story of Oswald shot it from this window on the sixth floor. So they wouldn't give us the sixth floor because that was where the museum was. We shot on the seventh floor. which is a little bit higher, but it's good enough to get the sense of the direction.
Can I ask you emotionally, like, just like stepping back, you're making a movie and you're operating and everybody, you know, you and Bob, everybody's, you know, you're in the middle of filming it. But as you are recreating that moment emotionally, just for you, like, do you remember like what was going through your mind? Were you able to step back from it and go, this is crazy that we're like recreating this in the exact spot? I mean, it must have been wild for you as a filmmaker.
It was a responsibility to, I didn't want to screw it up, you know. Certainly you feel ghosts, you know, there's things like that. But on top of it, we had the Washington Post reporter, national security reporter, running around the set on day one, trying to get poison on us. And he was writing an article without telling us. And they actually pissed on us. They had a big Sunday piece coming up right after that. And it was making fun of our film. And the guy was operating from an earlier draft. So it's, you know, it was, I had so much on my mind. I was really preoccupied. It's so many details, you know. It's good in a way because you lose a sense of, if you get involved in something, you're not thinking about the, oh, Jesus Christ, you know, I'm breaking the barrier here.
Yeah.
I would love to drill down a little bit more into the Mr. X character, who's just a fascinating device that you gave yourself, the ability to include a lot of that information. But Sutherland's performance is just an absolute masterclass. How much time did you have with him to film? And can you talk a little bit about prepping with him just to get all of that right?
Just to make it clear, because some people are confused, you know, all that dialogue is very much based on what Fletcher Prouty told me. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force since World War II. He'd been a major. He was the focus officer providing hardware to the CIA, mm-hmm. their operations abroad in Laos, not in Laos, in Tibet, Indonesia. He'd been involved in several, you know, dirty ops. But he walked away from it all after this assassination because he felt like that something, it had gone wrong. Everything had gone wrong. And he was in that period of his life when he was older, and he was like giving us information about how the government does these ops. He was hated by them. I mean, there was so much discredit. It was like Jim Garrison. They tried to discredit him, but they couldn't because he had the goods. And all his details were very good. Mm-hmm. He knew Alan Dulles. He knew these people. You know, they dealt with each other. He knew the feel, which is important for me. And I also got some other military intelligence guys, John Newman, who gave. And there's a lot going into this movie. But Donald is a brilliant man. I have to tell you, he's a genius level in the sense that he absorbs very fast. Mm-hmm. I don't have to talk to him very much. That dialogue was heavy, and I knew he was a good actor, but I was shocked at how he spit it out, man. And he knew the pace. For himself, because, you know, I talked to Marlon Brando about the role, and I realized, you know, that it would be ridiculous to try to make a scene out of that much dialogue. It's about 15, 16 minutes of talking. He did it. He did it like on the money. And I don't think we did many retakes. He's very fast. He's very smart.
Because that character has to make it seem like it's completely second nature to them.
Yeah.
You know, like it's ingrained in them.
It's the whole nature of the movie, because up to there, it's a local story. It's New Orleans. Costner feels he's operating in the fishbowl, and kind of after he's with Sutherland, the whole thing becomes international and it changes the whole game.
No, it really does. Terrific scene.
Mr. Stone, I'm gonna switch gears just here for briefly, because, you know, we are a film podcast, and like your films have been so instrumental in my life in terms of shaping me and my love of cinema. And the film that I always think about when I think of you in terms of just my childhood, it was Natural Born Killers, because I remember, I know it sounds weird, but I would go to Blockbuster every single day, every other day, and I would pass by the Natural Born Killers VHS sitting there. And I just remember that film, and I remember finally seeing it and being like blown away by it. And I know Tarantino wrote the story for it. I wanted to ask you, just if you don't mind asking about that experience now, all these years later, what that film means to you now, like, because that was the film that like kind of like introduced me to your work at the age of 10. So
I think it's a very maligned film. And it's a one-off in the sense that when I went there And you know, I did it right after Heaven and Earth. Heaven and Earth is a classically shot film, beautiful, Vietnam. And then I went right into this mad, I was getting a divorce at the time. So perhaps that played a role in the anger and the cynicism of it. But I was really down on the press. The media had pissed me off so much with the JFK case. And now here they were in this, I saw the luridness of the what TV reporting was going to. You have to realize in that time, O.J. Simpson was the only thing they could talk about on the news, mm-hmm. a murder. And there were various other violent acts, but that's what they focused on to get the ratings. So the whole country seemed to be mad. We were driven by the need to see violence, which is a problem in America. It really is. And if you know, if you look at your just TV shows, I mean, it's just normal to have violence, to have some kind of good versus bad resolution. It's sad that we raise kids this way. And I was doing this as a throwing up in the face of all the stuff I saw on TV. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. And it's a chaotic film. Yeah. I love it. I spent a lot of time in the editing room. It's about 3,000 images or something like that. It's a hell of a film, and the editors were great.
Love that movie. Thank you for answering that.
And Bob shot it like crazy. We all were crazy at that point.
Yeah, that was a really interestingly well shot film. It's like chaotic's probably the best way to put it. I mean, it is absolutely insane.
No, it's controlled chaos. We didn't
control
it. And then we went back and did Nixon, which is a completely different style, which I loved, very classical style. But using some of the madness from them, natural born killers.
It's very much what I love about your filmography is right as people are trying to pigeonhole you into something, you go in a completely different direction.
Yeah. Oh, fuck them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to that end.
Spit my water out.
No, to that end.
The one thing in life I have a problem with is summing people up. They come in and they pigeonhole you. They say this, that. It's so boring. The thing about being a dramatist is being able to change identities and slip around things and become Richard Nixon or Jim Morrison, or you know, just have fun with it and become you go outside yourself in the year that you make that film. And I did. I'd be Jim Morrison in one film, and then I turn into Richard Nixon in the next.
You do.
Can I ask about the real fast? You said you're Jim Morrison, then you turn into the other. Do you think of it like that? Like you're that person telling the story, kind of.
I identify with the character. So when I did George Bush, you know, the people say, "Why are you doing George Bush?" You know, they didn't understand that I have to get in his shoes. I have to empathize with him. It's not like I approve of what he did. I want to understand how you can go to war like that and how you can believe this nonsense. And the same thing is true about Nixon. I mean, Nixon hurt our country in many ways, but I knew my father and I had that, and I wanted to get inside that character. So that's really what it's about, getting inside people.
Knowing your fascination for controversial world leaders like this, are you workshopping a Trump project that we should brace for in a few years?
I would watch that.
Yeah, he doesn't interest me as much because I'm not going to do that.
good. Real quick, I just want to end on this, if you don't mind, because we're running out of time. You said earlier that you thought that this might be your last movie, which is fascinating to me because it ended up becoming so beloved and was a Best Picture nominee. And so, you know, you said basically your response to the people who, you know, want to pigeonhole you is fuck them. This is a bit of a victory lap for you. Do you see it that way? Do you see the fact that the movie is still the topic of conversation 30 years later and has had that resonance? Do you feel that you succeeded, that it went beyond what you ever dreamed possible for it?
It went beyond in the underground sense. You know, I mean, there is an audience for the film, but the official academies of whatever the establishment calls, it's not acceptable. So, you know, it's always that way. But I think America's got to grow up, you know, and stop seeing, you know, they can't accept the idea of assassination of a president and that we did it. You know, that they can't accept the idea that we're like the rest of the world. You know, we are. Things that happen in France, Russia, Italy, happen here too. And there's no difference. We consider ourselves better than other people, which I find racist. I find that to be very arrogant quality American corporation executives and war leaders have, presidents. You know, we are the standard. I'm trying to say, well, look at this. You know, you have problems. We have problems. So it's a message that's hard to put across at in this day and age, especially after 2001 when Bush hit the Patriot drums.
Yeah, very true. Well, I'm thrilled that this movie is still part of the conversation. Oliver, yeah. I know that we're so excited that you were a guest on the show. We really appreciate you coming by, and we can't wait for everybody to check out the director's cut of this film. And the four-hour cut that you say is coming. That's amazing.
Four-hour cut is coming.
Excellent.
We look forward to it. Thank you, Mr. Stone. Thanks for all the movies. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye, guys.
Naturally, we want to thank Warner Brothers Home Entertainment and Oliver Stone himself for coming on the show and being our very last show of 2021. We are wrapping up the year. We'll be back next week with a full-on episode. Premium members, you're going to get an episode on Monday as normal. But for the rest of us, we're taking some time off of the holiday, and we'll see you guys when we get back to it. Hopefully, we'll be doing our top 10s of 2021 and maybe even doing a most anticipated show. We might have a couple of fun things coming for the 200th episode because it's a landmark for Real Blend. So happy holidays to you guys. Hope you all have a very happy new year. Thank you, as always, for supporting the show. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you guys checking us out every single week. Tell a friend about the show. If you're here on the YouTube channel, hit like and subscribe. You'll get all of our new videos as soon as they drop. And we'll be heading into 2022 guns a-blazing. We'll talk to you guys soon. Hope everything's well. Stay safe. Talk to you later.